Ken Forrester, Executive Director at Momenta. Welcome to our Digital Thread podcast, produced by, for, and about digital industry leaders. In this series of conversations, we capture insights from the best and brightest minds in digital industry. They're executives, entrepreneurs, advisors, and other thought leaders. What they have in common is, like our team at Momenta, they are deep industry operators. We hope you find these podcasts informative. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Good day and welcome to episode 229 of Momenta Industrial Impact Podcast. Today, I'm pleased to host Gail Shepherd, Global Director for Astroscale. Gail previously served as Chief Executive Officer of Bright Machines, a software-defined factory automation company. Prior, she served as Corporate Vice President and Chief Technology Officer for Microsoft Asia, where she was responsible for establishing the vision, strategy, and execution programs for customer and partner co-innovation and digital transformation. Prior to that, she served as the Head of Global Expansion and Digital Transformation for Microsoft Cloud and AI, and as the Corporate Vice President of Azure Data at Microsoft. Earlier in her career, Gail served as CEO of Saffron Technology and later as Vice President and General Manager of the Saffron AI/ML division at Intel. She has founded, created, or contributed to startup and Fortune 100 companies focused on artificial intelligence platforms, solutions in business and consumer markets, and digitization of business in a wide variety of industries. Gail, welcome to our Industrial Impact Podcast.
Thank you, Ken. I'm excited to be here with you today and to talk with your listeners.
Thank you. Well, I'll tell you, this is really a timely podcast. We have decided to theme this Cognitive at Scale. And for anybody who's been watching the press's treatment of Gen AI as of late, you cannot turn anywhere without that being the topic du jour. So, as you know, we used to call this the Digital Thread Podcast, and we really started to look at this idea of industrial impact. And so we always start still with our signature question, and that really is, what would you consider to be your digital thread? In other words, the defining interests and experiences that brought you to this point in life, Gail.
Gosh, I'm going to start with the beginning. This is such a critical question. So it starts with being a natural builder, and I am so fortunate that when I was 6 years old, my father, who literally was a builder and started his own construction company, took me with him on his Saturday job walks. So I'm a six-year-old. I'm on the Saturday job walks. And what's cool about Saturday on construction sites is they're sparsely occupied. And you have a chance to walk around, see what's going on, what's been working, not working, and talk with people. And so I'm following my father around, who is a great customer-centric entrepreneur, by the way, and shared many times his philosophy with me, which will be one of my digital threads, is that regardless of what you think, the customer is always right. And he maintained a dedicated workforce. It was augmented by subcontractors. So he also operated within an ecosystem, which will become really important to me in my journey through technology. So I had this firsthand learning of my dad's interaction with his workforce, subcontractors, and customers. And he was a respected leader. He was a domain expert, yet knew that he was surrounded by a workforce of experts. And he leaned in to listen and learn from them, creating what we think of today as a continuous learning culture, and one based on to get respect, you give respect. And so there's the foundation for what will become a digital transformation journey throughout my career. There are roughly, I would say, a couple of things, there may be four or five points here that follow on here to this learning basis my father gave me. One is a cross-industry transfer. So I really started life in construction and farming, but I will have touched every industry by now, from aerospace, manufacturing, financial services, retail, telecom, heavy engineering, consumer products, and engagements with national government. So I have had this wonderful benefit to not only go deep into some of those industries, but also to transfer knowledge and learning across industry, which has served me well. In addition to that, I've been global since 1992 when I first went to Asia Pacific to lead the growth of Asia for J.D. Edwards and then onward to Japan. And so having this global perspective, North America, South America, Middle East, and Africa, right, the Asia and Europe has been informative and helps, again, when you're going helping companies make digital transformations that are global companies, really that cross-culture, cross-geopolitical environment is helpful. I also think that this customer-centric innovation and growth is in my DNA, and anyone who's ever worked with me closely knows that true joy comes from working with customers. The more exposure, the better. And so it's where true learning, as I would learn from my father, where true learning begins. And this direct engagement with customers also helps while you're understanding their unique needs, and you can also anticipate what they don't understand they need and help shape that with them. And then ultimately, it's the force that helps us design technology that delights and scales. It's the force and energy behind building and growing diverse teams. And it is the wisdom of participating in scaling strategic ecosystems. And then I would also say two more things. One is ethical technology use and social impact. Not front of mind for me so many years ago, but today with AI machine learning, my experiences at Saffron, my experiences at Microsoft, my experiences at Bright Machine, it is so fundamental that we have this in the forefront of our minds in terms of the future of AI. And then finally, I think resilience and adaptability. So we've been through some pretty, or I at least have been through some pretty interesting times, from the dot-com boom to 9/11 to the 2008 financial market meltdown to the most recent episodic memory of the pandemic. And each one of these businesses turned down and businesses turned back up again. And so having the resilience and adaptability to learn from that, grow from that, is a vital part of a digital transformation journey.
What a great set of attributes and experiences that you talk about there. That's why I always love asking that open-ended question about the digital thread, because you never quite know how somebody's going to answer that. So let me go right to probably what a lot of people are most interested in. We'll start with the end game in some sense. So you've been at the forefront of key enterprise and AI platforms for several decades. With that perspective, let me ask, what surprised you most and maybe least about the proliferation of AI today and really the hype around it?
Great question. As I'm thinking about this question, natural language processing is that thing that was a barrier to what I think of as rapid scale out of technology like Saffron's 15, 20 years ago. And so natural language processing was so rudimentary. But today, it is taken for granted as it plays a critical role by enabling machines to understand and interpret and generate human language. And so much of what of the AI we use today, whether they're chatbots, translation tools, voice-to-text translation versus foreign language, sentiment analysis that we're very familiar with, information extraction, and ChatGPT, for example, these are seamless human-computer interactions enabled by natural language processing. And so I guess what surprises me the most is how rapidly it advanced and how sophisticated it has become, such that we don't even notice it any longer. It's just running on our behalf. On the other hand, what surprises me the least is the ongoing rigorous governance required to ensure that we get this right, that we have an ethical approach to AI, that we have role-based information access in enterprises, that we have basically a zero trust environment in the enterprise, so that we can protect data, we can protect its use, and we can protect the privacy of information within, and to make sure that our customers and our employees are secure and protected in that way. We have a lot to do on that theme regarding bias. And eliminating bias is essential to our future of success in using AI. That's hard to do, of course, but we think about it today. Models are inherently biased, and so they're making recommendations. They may be automating decisions. And so it's really important that we have explainability on how they work, how they make decisions, so that we have that full transparency. And we also need to make sure we're quite aware of any limitations imposed on the results that we're asking AI to help us derive. So I think bias is an important thing that's yet ahead of us, Ken. And then one thing I'd like to point out that I just learned yesterday is that the Conference Board, which is an organization that works closely with CEOs, did a survey recently, and 70% of CEOs believe that they are going to have to rethink their business model over the next few years, right? So they're on top of understanding that. They are working closely with their boards and their management teams. 90% believe that AI will have a game-changing impact on productivity. So these fundamentals of we're going to change productivity with AI and we're going to have to re-engineer, transform our businesses again with AI are in the forefront of minds of the executives running the corporations. And I believe that there's a lot yet to be learned. And this is probably one of the more exciting moments in time for all of us who've been engaged with AI so far.
Wow, I'd have to fully agree. And those are some amazing stats. But it's interesting, you know, we tend to operate in the, operating technology space more than necessarily the enterprise IT. And the number of conferences I've been to as of late, even by large industrial OEMs, where they talk about the impact they foresee on businesses, their own workers and everything else, is, I'd say, relatively unprecedented in any technology that I've seen in the past. So I agree with you. It's a really amazing time to be in this space. You mentioned Safran, and I'm not sure everybody's well familiar with the company. So let's drill down a little bit on your time with Safran. So this was one of the first cognitive computing system companies. As you said, their natural intelligence platform was used across manufacturing, energy, defense, healthcare, to help decision makers manage risks, identify opportunities, and anticipate future outcomes. So really, it was quite a high flyer for the time. I think you even had the former national security advisor, John Poindexter, on the board at the time. And of course, ultimately competing with IBM Watson. So tell us a little bit about the company and, more importantly, what you're most proud of having been their CEO.
Well, it certainly was a brilliant moment in time for me. I think this will be my first introduction to a more modern AI. So growing up in statistical modeling and things of this sort, now we're moving away from modeling and we're moving toward being able to make sense of connection patterns and the context of those connections in data, both structured and unstructured. So that's the genesis of Safran. Safran was formed by Dr. Manny Aparicio and the late Jim Fleming. They were researchers at IBM, by the way. And so they left with IBM's full approval to go work on the crossbar scaling problem that limited what will be called associative memory technology from being applied into large data problems. And so that problem they were solving and had just patented, actually, when I met them. And we were both associated with the Keenan Institute, the University of North Carolina Keenan Flagler School of Business, and they have an entrepreneurial school called the Keenan Institute. And this group brings people together from businesses and academia, as well as public policy. So I meet these two gentlemen there, and we have a conversation. I've recently left enterprise software. I'm a research fellow at the Keenan Institute working in supply chain, but was asked to meet Manny and Jim. Long story, a little less long. I have this great conversation with them. They share with me what they're doing. I'm very excited about it. They asked me to be their CEO, and I said no, because it's way too early for me to be your CEO, but I can help. And so I invest in the company. I actually help them raise a round, and I become engaged day by day, helping identify problems that can be solved, working with customers like the Defense Department and some healthcare customers on how we could apply this technology to solve some complex problems that they are wishing to resolve. And on it goes. So 5 years later, after that, I become the CEO. We've had great proof points. And now we're into scaling out the business when we meet Intel. And so Intel will be an important partner for us. They invested in the company. They use the technology in-house. And they also helped us develop an edge portion of the technology, or an edge version of the technology. While doing that, we are solving some very serious problems. And so you asked the question, what are my most proud moments? Clearly, the work that we did in the IED defeat program early on, 2007 and 2008, will be important as we're helping identify supply chains feeding parts for bombs and helping solve or reduce the impact on American and well as allied soldiers. The ability to work in healthcare and actually in cardiology and make distinctions between a heart disease A and heart disease B, and which their impact is significantly different. One results in death and one results in health issues, but nevertheless, to be able to discern the differences between those and help cardiologists with their diagnosis and improve people's lives were moments in time that are significant to me in our work. Ultimately, the sale of Safran to Intel will be also, as a CEO, an important moment because our investors will have received a very good return on their investment. And these investors were individuals as well as a few strategic investors. And so it always has to be a proud moment when you do an exit of that type.
So you exited the company at Intel in 2015, and unfortunately and unceremoniously, they shuttered it 3 years later. Now, going back to that time and knowing what you do now about the renewed interest in AI, what would you have done differently at the time, if anything?
Well, I stayed with Intel for 3 years, by the way, helping build a software company within Intel. So we did that. You know, I think I would have sold the company if I knew then what I know now. I would have rallied the investors. I would convince them that the right thing to do is to keep going. But there was the pressure to exit from investors. And so therefore we did. I think the other thing one should remember is during that period of time, NVIDIA was rising, right? So gaming, cryptocurrency, cloud, vision, and other things were driving the growth of the GPU, which Intel had not invested in. And so as a result, Intel had to focus in on their core business. And effectively, what happened is the CEO left the business, the CFO became the CEO, the company was therefore refocused back on their core business of developing and producing silicon. And therefore, anything not related to the chip, if you will, was de-invested. And so that's how Saffron became a de-investment. The company wasn't sold off. The assets weren't, put in the trash. They went back to Intel Research. But nevertheless, for Intel, it was the right thing to do if we look back at that, and their focus on their business. What I can say is my 3 years at Intel, we applied Saffron for internal use and supply chain and some of their parts of the business. We built pipelines with customers and educated the marketplace about Intel and AI and Intel's ability to deliver software. And we built a strong AI marketing team and sales team within Intel that would continue onward after the Saffron team left. So all in, I can look back on it and say, darn, but it was another part of the adventure, right? And another part of the learning and transformation that takes place for us as individuals, as well as companies.
And human nature is we always assume that the path we didn't take would have been as favorable as we can think in at this time, right? And the reality is a 50-50, right? It could be more favorable, could be less favorable, right? And certainly heading into the pandemic and, all of the other wonderful shocks that we had to the system after that, things could have been negative. But I still wonder, because Saffron was such a high flyer. It kind of reminds me of Banzai, which, of course, Microsoft bought, unfortunately, almost did the same, unceremoniously kind of shuttered it. But it's interesting to think, what could have been. So speaking of Microsoft, let's fast forward to your time there. So you served as a key leader in Japan, which you had also done with J.D. Edwards prior. What attracted you to Japan and what were some of your key accomplishments?
Well, it's interesting. My time in Japan, first of all, with J.D. Edwards was in the mid to late 90s. And I would consider that the second most impactful time of my career, with Saffron being the first and Microsoft will be the third. But building an enterprise software business in Japan was personally transformative. You're building multicultural teams. You're learning the importance and meaning of culture to work and life, right? How diversity is a force multiplier for innovation. And back to my father's philosophy that the customer is always right. That's true in Japan, and that customer commitment trumps everything else. So these key accomplishments are rooted in these learnings and the transference over to Microsoft. For Microsoft, I chose to be based in Tokyo due to Japan's critical market position for the region, but I was CTO for Asia Pacific. And the mission I was asked to perform was to create a CTO organization across Asia Pacific and every major operating country that we're in, which were many, and to create that, develop that muscle of true depth of understanding of the local customer and the local industries while being able to apply global practices from digital transformation learned around the globe into the local customer, the local economy. And so Asia Pacific being probably I don't wish to call anything at Microsoft immature because that's a bad word to use for a company of this stature, but certainly being able to develop that technology intensity for Asia Pacific was on the mind of leadership at Microsoft. So that was my mission. And I was there just a short period of time in that role. Remember, I have prior roles where I've led global expansion, planning, and launching of clouds around the world, as well as the data product portfolio. So you know, that experience would certainly allow me to define, design, you know, what would be a strong CTO program for Asia Pacific. But I would get distracted by Bright Machines before I finished my mission. But a team was formed and left behind that did. So I'm proud of that.
I like that. Got distracted with Bright Machines. We'll get to that in a minute because obviously that's a core interest. But I'm curious, does Microsoft's recent headlong move into AI, thus the Copilot, if you will, surprise you at all?
Not at all, actually. You know, and I'm thinking about this too, this question in terms of ecosystems and how the future is going to look for business. And I think Microsoft exemplifies that ecosystem strategy and the importance of ecosystems to building, first of all, to delivering great results for customers and two, for building great companies. And so I expect nothing less of Microsoft to do something like, you know, make this major investment in OpenAI and then and stay the course with them. And it was driven by Satya, yes, and chief members of his very senior leadership team. And I think Microsoft is great at building ecosystems and selecting which partners to invest in. And they have a history of that across their business portfolio. And so, no, I'm not surprised. And I'm excited. I'm excited for Microsoft, myself, and for all of us who are benefiting from it.
Excellent. So let's jump on into Bright Machines since you raised that. So again, a software-defined factory automation company. So there's a tagline for you. So tell us a little bit about the company and your factory automation focus.
Wow. So factory automation is crucial, as you know, for revitalizing U.S. manufacturing, enhancing our own competitiveness here in this country, as well as other countries that are trying to do the same thing, which is to reshore manufacturing that they had offshored, if you will, in the 90s and the 2000s. And you think about automation and Bright Machines' role, right? So automation improves efficiency. It helps reduce labor costs, or in the event you can't hire labor, allow you to produce and assemble products in country that couldn't be done without automation. And it increases production speed and it increases production quality. So there's so many positive attributes to the idea of automating assembly and the framework that Bright Machines is using. I think also what excited me about Bright Machines, and this shouldn't be a commercial about Bright Machines, but what excited me about them is what's happening in the industry more broadly, which is integrating software and machine learning-based intelligence capabilities to deliver in more speed, more throughput, more operational efficiency on the production line, higher quality products, more secure products with the use of vision inspection automated along the way down the line. And so all of these things, one, give the customer more power, give the customer more control of the outcomes being assembled and produced in their production capabilities, as well as, I believe, create operational efficiencies and potentially improve the cost of production. And then finally, if you think about new product design, if we can automate that, right, if we can use our vision capabilities for actually understanding the new design, let's say we're looking at a server, we can quickly identify what the process will be, the skills needed to build the new server. And then we can, of course, obviously get the bill of materials and other things associated with that that are necessary to actually complete the build. This shortens the time to introduce new products dramatically, taking it from months potentially to weeks, if not days. And so these are the benefits of factory automation. These are some of the things that Bright Machines is doing or trying to do, and why I was excited about this next transformation for the manufacturing industry.
I can clearly see that. It's interesting when you first introduced yourself to the digital thread question, you really painted a very broad picture of all the things that you've done. And moving from enterprise IT to OT certainly makes that quite a jump as well. I also noted you're a director at both Nutanix and Astroscale. So truly taking your leadership from, I'll call it the near edge to the extreme far edge of space. I guess in between those two extremes, what are some of the key trends you were watching these days?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Nutanix reveals what will be the multiple cloud adoption problem, right? So this is where enterprises have separated or separate clouds operating independently as independent silos within and across a company around across the world. And so the business risks are notable. As we were just discussing AI a few minutes ago, you know, the inability to have data unified in some way across all of your operating IT environments is a limiter. And so, and it adds, you know, it adds cost to your business. It adds unnecessary risk to managing these critical data assets, which are always under attack, and their security. And so being a data executive, this latter point is most concerning, right? That you have a way of controlling your multiple cloud environments. And so Nutanix is solving for that problem. And that's not a problem that's going to go away anytime soon. In fact, one of the data points that is notable here is that 53% of IT professionals surveyed said their organizations move data between data centers and public cloud services every day, and 50% between multiple cloud services regularly or all the time. So you've got this high amount of data movement. And with data movement, anytime we're moving things, we increase the risk of loss. And so for an environment to be optimal, must provide consistency across these locations and the providers, both on and off premises. So that's the problem Nutanix is solving by creating a fabric of allowing organizations to run applications and databases with consistency and performance and the scalability required across locations as if it were a single platform, and therefore minimizing the data movement complications and also the dependency on humans to be in the loop 100% of the time. I think that also this capability of Nutanix, as I was thinking about CEOs and the problems they're facing, that it's enabler to helping them rethink their business models and implementing game-changing productivity impact that they're talking about. So, you know, having Nutanix on the forefront of that is exciting, and I'm excited myself to be part of the team there, to be on the board, and to be helping shape strategy as boards do. And Astroscale solves another problem of great interest. A real problem today is one that is also increasing in scope and scale, is space sustainability. So our daily lives are powered by services from space, and satellites are going to continue to benefit our lives every single day here on Earth, with tens of thousands of them expected to be launched over the next decade. However, can the orbital highways are already dangerous and risky. So a sustainable infrastructure is required for us to decrease the risk of the services being offered and increase value for operators, and also to enjoy the benefits that we get today from space in our daily communications and in our daily lives. So you think about Astroscale is offering operators and launchers these choices and flexibility across the spectrum of what we think of as on-orbit servicing. So creating a sustainable foundation for the growth of the space economy in the process, but literally launching missions that are operating in orbit to eliminate a no longer functioning device, to do on-orbit repair, and also on-orbit analysis and surveillance of an asset to determine how and what to do with it. And these are new skills, new capabilities that Astroscale has funded and is launching, has launched and is launching today in space. They are going to change and revolutionize the future of space, making it much more safe, also extending the life of assets that operate in space today, as well as inventing who knows what next. So it's an exciting company to be involved with, an exciting market segment to be involved with. It's very nascent, and one that I think is a defining moment for the future of space and its use by Earth. So I'm excited to be on that board. I'm on the global board of Astroscale. There are also local boards. We have operations, for example, here in the United States, and that organization is based in Colorado Springs and is a terrific, in Denver, and is a terrific example of how the company works with local governments and local organizations. So one other thing I would also note for the listeners, if you're interested in this topic, the European Space Agency publishes an annual report, and I think it's called The Current State of Space Debris, and the last one was published in September 2023. So if you have interest in this particular domain from a technology point of view or otherwise, that's a good place to go and become more familiar with the problem.
Excellent resource. I'm going to ask the question everybody's wondering, given your very successful career trajectory and background. What is next for you, Gail?
A vacation.
I'm going to go to Disneyland.
But truthfully, I've made a decision to focus on strategic board work and to work with companies that are really changing the way we think about and solve for problems that are real in our lives today, but have not yet been tended to, if you will. I love that the two themes I'm currently in via Astroscale and Nutanix. However, I think the Gen AI and this whole new digital transformation yet ahead of us that the CEOs are talking about in terms of worker productivity and redefining business models is a new generation of opportunity to be thinking and creating. So I'll be paying a lot of attention there. One of the things I've recently done is I've always wanted to attend Wharton. And so I enrolled in a Wharton C-level class program. And I'm using that program to really take all of the learning from this history we've talked about today and putting it into a structure so I can take my own experience and reuse it appropriately for the companies and people that I work with and support. I'm very excited about that. And one last thing, I'm fascinated by markets. I have more time today to really pay attention to what's happening geopolitically and in the financial markets. And I'm reading a book, How to Listen When Markets Speak by Lawrence McDonald, as fuel for my learning here. And I'll let you know how that turns out.
Oh, you are certainly keeping busy. I cannot imagine somebody who has more potential in terms of their next steps. You've clearly done board work. You've done CXO work. You've worked in Asia and North America. And clearly your background with AI particularly really sets you up for so many different ways that you can go. So I think certainly your most impactful days are probably ahead of you, Gail.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
So you already mentioned one book. And as a wrap up, I'm just curious how you maintain your edge as a leader. Any recommendations you would like to share beyond the book and the Wharton course you already mentioned?
Well, you know, I think first of all, Ken, and you share this, is curiosity, right? So just be curious and explore things that you want to know more about, right? And don't worry about where that takes you so much. So I think reading and listening to podcasts or watching videos on YouTube or whatever your source is, keep doing that. You know, I have a couple books I'm reading. I always have too many at one time, but I'm reading Hidden Potential by Adam Grant. Another one that's really relevant right now with AI is Frames of Mind, The Theory of Multiple Intelligences by Howard Gardner. It's a book from 2011, but I had touched on it many years ago. I'm going back to read it. And then I mentioned how to listen when markets speak. So those are three different interest areas for me right now.
Wow, Gail, I really appreciate you taking this time and sharing these great insights with us today.
Ken, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I so appreciate being invited to be here. And I hope that your listeners have enjoyed this chat and our time together. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. And I think this will certainly be a very timely conversation for many different reasons. So this has been Gail Shepherd, Global Director for Astroscale. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the next episode of our Industrial Impact Podcast. We wish you an impactful day. You've been listening to the Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. We hope you've enjoyed the discussion. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Please check our website at momenta.one for archived versions of podcasts, as well as resources to help with your digital industry journey. Thank you for listening.